Chapter 14. Guard. Qui est là?
Bucel.
Paysans, pauvres gens de France.
King Henry VI. During the rapid movement from the blockhouse, and until the party was deeply buried in the forest, each individual was too much interested in the escape to hazard a word even in whispers. The scout resumed his post in the advance, though his steps, after he had thrown a safe distance between himself and his enemies, were more deliberate than in their previous march, in consequence of his utter ignorance of the localities of the surrounding woods. More than once he halted to consult with his confederates, the Mohicans, pointing upwards at the moon and examining the barks of the trees with care. In these brief pauses, Hayward and the sisters listened, with senses rendered doubly acute by the danger, to detect any symptoms which might announce the proximity of their foes. At such moments, it seemed as if a vast range of country lay buried in eternal sleep, not the least sound arising from the forest, unless it was the distant and scarcely audible rippling of a watercourse. Birds, beasts, and man appeared to slumber alike, if indeed any of the latter were to be found in that wide tract of wilderness. But the sounds of the rivulet, feeble and murmuring as they were, relieved the guides at once from no trifling embarrassment, and towards it they immediately held their way. When the banks of the little stream were gained, Hawkeye made another halt, and taking the moccasins from his feet, he invited Hayward and Gamut to follow his example. He then entered the water, and for near an hour they traveled in the bed of the brook, leaving no trail. The moon had already sunk into an immense pile of black clouds, which lay impending above the western horizon, when they issued from the low and devious watercourse to rise again to the light and level of the sandy but wooded plain. Here the scout seemed to be once more at home, for he held on his way with the certainty and diligence of a man who moved in the security of his own knowledge. The path soon became more uneven, and the travelers could plainly perceive that the mountains drew nigher to them on each hand, and that they were, in truth, about entering one of their gorges. Suddenly Hawkeye made a pause, and waiting until he was joined by the whole party, he spoke, though in tones so low and cautious that they added to the solemnity of his words in the quiet and darkness of the place. "It is easy to know the pathways, and to find the licks and watercourses of the wilderness," he said. "But who that saw this spot could venture to say that a mighty army was at rest among yonder silent trees and barren mountains?" "We are then at no great distance from William Henry," said Hayward, advancing nigher to the scout. "It is yet a long and weary path, and when and where to strike it is now our greatest difficulty. See," he said, pointing through the trees towards a spot where a little basin of water reflected the stars from its placid bosom. "Here is the bloody pond, and I am on the ground that I have not only often traveled, but over which I have fought the enemy from the rising to the setting sun."
"Ha! That sheet of dull and dreary water, then, is the sepulchre of the brave men who fell in the contest. I have heard it named, but never have I stood on its banks before."
"Three battles did we make with the Dutch Frenchmen in a day," continued Hawkeye, pursuing the train of his own thoughts rather than replying to the remark of Duncan. "He met us hard by in our outward march to ambush his advance and scattered us like driven deer through the defile to the shores of Horican. Then we rallied behind our fallen trees and made head against him under Sir William, who was made Sir William for that very deed. And well did we pay him for the disgrace of the morning. Hundreds of Frenchmen saw the sun that day for the last time, and even the leader, Dieskau himself, fell into our hands, so cut and torn with the lead that he has gone back to his own country unfit for further acts in war."
"'Twas a noble repulse," exclaimed Hayward in the heat of his youthful ardor. "The fame of it reached us early in our southern army."
"Aye, but it did not end there. I was sent by Major Effingham, at Sir William's own bidding, to outflank the French and carry the tidings of their disaster across the portage to the fort on the Hudson. Just here away, where you see the trees rise into a mountain swell, I met a party coming down to our aid, and I led them where the enemy were taking their meal, little dreaming that they had not finished the bloody work of the day."
"And you surprised them?"
"If death can be a surprise to men who are thinking only of the cravings of their appetites. We gave them but little breathing time, for they had borne hard upon us in the fight of the morning. and there were few in our party who had not lost friend or relative by their hands. When all was over, the dead, and some say the dying, were cast into that little pond. These eyes have seen its waters colored with blood, as natural water never yet flowed from the bowels of the earth. It was a convenient, and I trust will prove a peaceful grave for a soldier. You have, then, seen much service on this frontier?
Aye, said the scout, erecting his tall person with an air of military pride. There are not many echoes among these hills that haven't rung with the crack of my rifle. Nor is there the space of a square mile atwixt Horican and the river that Killdeer hasn't dropped a living body on, be it an enemy or be it a brute beast. As for the grave there, being as quiet as you mention, it is another matter. There are them in the camp who say and think, man, to lie still should not be buried while the breath is in the body. And certain it is that in the hurry of that evening, the doctors had but little time to say who was living and who was dead.
Hist! I see you nothing walking on the shore of the pond. 'Tis not probable that any are as houseless as ourselves in this dreary forest.
Such as he may care but little for house or shelter, and night dew can never wet a body that passes its days in the water, returned the scout, grasping the shoulder of Hayward with such convulsive strength as to make the young soldier painfully sensible how much superstitious terror had got the mastery of a man usually so dauntless.
By heaven, there is a human form, and it approaches. Stand to your arms, my friends, for we know not whom we encounter.
Qui vive? Demanded a stern, quick voice which sounded like a challenge from another world issuing out of that solitary and solemn place.
What says it? Whispered the scout. It speaks neither Indian nor English.
Qui vive? Repeated the same voice, which was quickly followed by the rattling of arms and a menacing attitude.
France!
Cried Hayward, advancing from the shadow of the trees to the shore of the pond, within a few yards of the sentinel.
D'où venez-vous? Où allez-vous, d'aussi bonheur?
Demanded the grenadier in the language and with the accent of a man from old France.
Je viens de la découverte, et je vais me coucher.
Êtes-vous officier du roi?
Sans doute, mon camarade. Me prends-tu pour un provincial? Je suis capitaine de chasseurs.
Hayward well knew that the other was of a regiment in the line.
J'ai ici avec moi les filles du commandant de la fortification.
Aha! Tu en as entendu parler.
Je les ai fait prisonnières près de l'autre fort, et je les conduis au général.
Ma foi, mesdames, j'en suis fâché pour vous, exclaimed the young soldier, touching his cap with grace. Mais, fortune de guerre, vous trouverez notre général un brave homme, et bien poli avec les dames.
C'est le caractère des gens de guerre, said Cora with admirable self-possession. Adieu, mon ami. Je vous souhaiterai un devoir plus agréable à remplir.
The soldier made a low and humble acknowledgment for her civility, and Hayward adding a
Bonne nuit, mon camarade.
They moved deliberately forward, leaving the sentinel pacing the banks of the silent pond, little suspecting an enemy of so much effrontery, and humming to himself those words which were recalled to his mind by the sight of women, and perhaps by recollections of his own distant and beautiful France.
Vive le vin, l'amour, etc., etc.
'Tis well you understood the knave, whispered the scout, when they had gained a little distance from the place, and letting his rifle fall into the hollow of his arm again. I soon saw that he was one of them uneasy Frenchers, and well for him it was that his speech was friendly and his wishes kind, or a place might have been found for his bones among those of his countrymen. He was interrupted by a long and heavy groan which arose from the little basin, as though, in truth, the spirits of the departed lingered about their watery sepulchre. Surely it was of flesh, continued the scout. No spirit could handle its arms so steadily.
It was of flesh, but whether the poor fellow still belongs to this world may well be doubted,
said Hayward, glancing his eyes around him and missing Chingachgook from their little band. Another groan, more faint than the former, was succeeded by a heavy and sullen plunge into the water, and all was as still again as if the borders of the dreary pool had never been awakened from the silence of creation. While they yet hesitated in uncertainty, the form of the Indian was seen gliding out of the thicket. As the chief rejoined them, with one hand he attached the reeking scalp of the unfortunate young Frenchman to his girdle, and with the other he replaced the knife and tomahawk that had drunk his blood. He then took his wonted station, with the air of a man who believed he had done a deed of merit. The scout dropped one end of his rifle to the earth, and leaning his hands on the other, he stood musing in profound silence. Then, shaking his head in a mournful manner, he muttered, "'Twould have been a cruel and an unhuman act for a white skin, but 'tis the gift and nature of an Indian, and I suppose it should not be denied. I could wish, though, it had befallen an accursed Mingo rather than that gay young boy from the old countries."
"Enough," said Hayward. Apprehensive, the unconscious sisters might comprehend the nature of the detention,
and conquering his disgust by a train of reflections very much like that of the hunter,
"'Tis done, and though better it were left undone, cannot be amended. You see, we are, too obviously, within the sentinels of the enemy. What course do you propose to follow?"
"Yes," said Hawkeye, rousing himself again. "'Tis, as you say, too late to harbor further thoughts about it. Aye, the French have gathered around the fort in good earnest, and we have a delicate needle to thread in passing them."
"And but little time to do it in," added Hayward, glancing his eyes upward toward the bank of vapor that concealed the setting moon.
"And little time to do it in," repeated the scout. "The thing may be done in two fashions, by the help of Providence, without which it may not be done at all."
"Name them quickly, for time presses."
"One would be to dismount the gentle ones and let their beasts range the plain. By sending the Mohicans in front, we might then cut a lane through their sentries and enter the fort over the dead bodies."
"It will not do, it will not do," interrupted the generous Hayward. "A soldier might force his way in this manner, but never with such a convoy."
"'Twould be indeed a bloody path for tender feet to wade in," returned the equally reluctant scout. "But I thought it befitting my manhood to name it. We must then turn on our trail and get without the line of their lookouts, when we will bend short to the west and enter the mountains, where I can hide you so that all the devil's hounds in Montcalm's pay would be thrown off the scent for months to come."
"Let it be done, and that instantly."
Further words were unnecessary, for Hawkeye, merely uttering the mandate to follow, moved along the route by which they had just entered their present critical and even dangerous situation. Their progress, like their late dialogue, was guarded, and without noise, for none knew at what moment a passing patrol or a crouching picket of the enemy might rise upon their path. As they held their silent way along the margin of the pond, again Hayward and the scout stole furtive glances at its appalling dreariness. They looked in vain for the form they had so recently seen stalking along its silent shores, while a low and regular wash of the little waves, by announcing that the waters were not yet subsided, furnished a frightful memorial of the deed of blood they had just witnessed. Like all that passing and gloomy scene, the low basin, however, quickly melted in the darkness and became blended with a mass of black objects in the rear of the travelers. Hawkeye soon deviated from the line of their retreat, and striking off towards the mountains which formed the western boundary of the narrow plain, he led his followers, with swift steps, deep within the shadows that were cast from their high and broken summits. The route was now painful, lying over ground ragged with rocks and intersected with ravines, and their progress proportionately slow. Bleak and black hills lay on every side of them, compensating in some degree for the additional toil of the march by the sense of security they imparted. At length the party began slowly to climb a steep and rugged ascent by a path that curiously wound among rocks and trees, avoiding the one and supported by the other, in a manner that showed it had been devised by men long practiced in the arts of the wilderness. As they gradually rose from the level of the valleys, the thick darkness which usually precedes the approach of day began to disperse, and objects were seen in the plain and palpable colors with which they had been gifted by nature. When they issued from the stunted woods which clung to the barren sides of the mountain upon a flat and mossy rock that formed its summit, they met the morning, as it came blushing above the green pines of a hill that lay on the opposite side of the valley of the Horican. The scout now told the sisters to dismount, and taking the bridles from the mouths and the saddles off the backs of the jaded beasts, he turned them loose to glean a scanty subsistence among the shrubs and meager herbage of that elevated region. "Go," he said, "and seek your food where nature gives it you. And beware that you become not food to ravenous wolves yourselves among these hills.
Have we no further need of them? Demanded Hayward.
See and judge with your own eyes, said the scout, advancing towards the eastern brow of the mountain, whither he beckoned for the whole party to follow. If it was as easy to look into the heart of man as it is to spy out the nakedness of Montcalm's camp from this spot, hypocrites would grow scarce, and the cunning of a Mingo might prove a losing game compared to the honesty of a Delaware. When the travelers reached the verge of the precipice, they saw, at a glance, the truth of the scout's declaration, and the admirable foresight with which he had led them to their commanding station. The mountain on which they stood, elevated perhaps 1,000 feet in the air, was a high cone that rose a little in advance of that range which stretches for miles along the western shores of the lake, until meeting its sister piles beyond the water, it ran off towards the Canadas in confused and broken masses of rock thinly sprinkled with evergreens. Immediately at the feet of the party, the southern shore of the Horican swept in a broad semicircle from mountain to mountain, marking a wide strand that soon rose into an uneven and somewhat elevated plain. To the north stretched the limpid, and as it appeared from that dizzy height, the narrow sheet of the Holy Lake, indented with numberless bays, embellished by fantastic headlands, and dotted with countless islands. At the distance of a few leagues, the bed of the waters became lost among mountains, or was wrapped in the masses of vapor that came slowly rolling along their bosom before a light morning air. But a narrow opening between the crests of the hills pointed out the passage by which they found their way still farther north, to spread their pure and ample sheets again before pouring out their tribute into the distant Champlain. To the south stretched the defile, or rather broken plain, so often mentioned. For several miles in this direction, the mountains appeared reluctant to yield their dominion. But within reach of the eye they diverged, and finally melted into the level and sandy lands across which we have accompanied our adventurers in their double journey. Along both ranges of hills, which bounded the opposite sides of the lake and valley, clouds of light vapor were rising in spiral wreaths from the uninhabited woods, looking like the smokes of hidden cottages, or rolled lazily down the declivities to mingle with the fogs of the lower land. A single solitary, snow-white cloud floated above the valley and marked the spot beneath which lay the silent pool of the Bloody Pond. Directly on the shore of the lake, and nearer to its western than to its eastern margin, lay the extensive earthen ramparts and low buildings of William Henry. Two of the sweeping bastions appeared to rest on the water which washed their bases, while a deep ditch and extensive morasses guarded its other sides and angles. The land had been cleared of wood for a reasonable distance around the work, but every other part of the scene lay in the green livery of nature, except where the limpid water mellowed the view, or the bold rocks thrust their black and naked heads above the undulating outline of the mountain ranges. In its front might be seen the scattered sentinels, who held a weary watch against their numerous foes, and within the walls themselves the travelers looked down upon men still drowsy with a night of vigilance. Towards the southeast, but in immediate contact with the fort, was an entrenched camp, posted on a rocky eminence that would have been far more eligible for the work itself, in which Hawkeye pointed out the presence of those auxiliary regiments that had so recently left the Hudson in their company. From the woods, a little farther to the south, rose numerous dark and lurid smokes that were easily to be distinguished from the purer exhalations of the springs, and which the scout also showed to Hayward as evidences that the enemy lay in force in that direction. But the spectacle which most concerned the young soldier was on the western bank of the lake, though quite near to its southern termination. On a strip of land which appeared, from his stand, too narrow to contain such an army, but which in truth extended many hundreds of yards from the shores of the Horican to the base of the mountain, were to be seen the white tents and military engines of an encampment of 10,000 men. Batteries were already thrown up in their front, and even while the spectators above them were looking down with such different emotions on a scene which lay like a map beneath their feet, the roar of artillery rose from the valley and passed off in thundering echoes along the eastern hills. Morning is just touching them below, said the deliberate and musing scout, and the watchers have a mind to wake up the sleepers by the sound of cannon. We are a few hours too late. Montcalm has already filled the woods with his accursed Iroquois.
The place is indeed invested, returned Duncan. But is there no expedient by which we may enter? Capture in the works would be far preferable to falling again into the hands of roving Indians.
See, exclaimed the scout, unconsciously directing the attention of Cora to the quarters of her own father, how that shot has made the stones fly from the side of the commandant's house. Aye, these Frenchers will pull it to pieces faster than it was put together, solid and thick though it be.
Heyward, I sicken at the sight of danger that I cannot share, said the undaunted but anxious daughter. Let us go to Montcalm and demand admission. He dare not deny a child the boon.
You would scarce find the tent of the Frenchman with the hair on your head, said the blunt scout. If I had but one of the 1,000 boats which lie empty along that shore, it might be done. Here will soon be an end of the firing, for yonder comes a fog that will turn day to night, and make an Indian arrow more dangerous than a molded cannon. Now, if you are equal to the work and will follow, I will make a push. For I long to get down into that camp, if it be only to scatter some Mingo dogs that I see lurking in the skirts of yonder thicket of birch.
We are equal, said Cora firmly. On such an errand we will follow to any danger.
The scout turned to her with a smile of honest and cordial approbation as he answered, I would I had 1,000 men of brawny limbs and quick eyes that feared death as little as you. I'd send them jabbering Frenchers back into their den again afore the week was ended, howling like so many fettered hounds or hungry wolves. But stir, he added, turning from her to the rest of the party. The fog comes rolling down so fast we shall have but just the time to meet it on the plain, and use it as a cover. Remember, if any accident should befall me, to keep the air blowing on your left cheeks, or rather, follow the Mohicans. They'd scent their way, be it in day or be it at night.
He then waved his hand for them to follow, and threw himself down the steep declivity, with free but careful footsteps.
Heyward assisted the sisters to descend, and in a few minutes they were all far down a mountain whose sides they had climbed with so much toil and pain. The direction taken by Hawkeye soon brought the travelers to the level of the plain, nearly opposite to a sallyport in the western curtain of the fort, which lay itself at the distance of about 1/2 mile from the point where he halted to allow Duncan to come up with his charge. In their eagerness, and favored by the nature of the ground, they had anticipated the fog, which was rolling heavily down the lake, and it became necessary to pause until the mists had wrapped the camp of the enemy in their fleecy mantle. The Mohicans profited by the delay to steal out of the woods and to make a survey of surrounding objects. They were followed at a little distance by the scout, with a view to profit early by their report and to obtain some faint knowledge for himself of the more immediate localities. In a very few moments he returned, his face reddened with vexation while he muttered his disappointment in words of no very gentle import. "Here has the cunning Frenchman been posting a picket directly in our path," he said. "Redskins and whites, and we shall be as likely to fall into their midst as to pass them in the fog." "Cannot we make a circuit to avoid the danger?" asked Heyward, "and come into our path again when it is past? Who that once bends from the line of his march in a fog can tell when or how to turn to find it again? The mists of Horican are not like the curls from a peace pipe, or the smoke which settles above a mosquito fire."
He was yet speaking, when a crashing sound was heard, and a cannonball entered the thicket, striking the body of a sapling and rebounding to the earth, its force being much expended by previous resistance. The Indians followed instantly like busy attendants on the terrible messenger, and Uncas commenced speaking earnestly and with much action in the Delaware tongue.
"It may be so, lad," muttered the scout when he had ended, "for desperate fevers are not to be treated like a toothache. Come then, the fog is shutting in."
"Stop," cried Heyward. "First explain your expectations."
"'Tis soon done, and a small hope it is. But it is better than nothing. This shot that you see," added the scout, kicking the harmless iron with his foot, "has plowed the earth in its road from the fort, and we shall hunt for the furrow it has made, when all other signs may fail. No more words but follow, or the fog may leave us in the middle of our path, a mark for both armies to shoot at.
Hayward, perceiving that in fact a crisis had arrived when acts were more required than words, placed himself between the sisters and drew them swiftly forward, keeping the dim figure of their leader in his eye. It was soon apparent that Hawkeye had not magnified the power of the fog, for before they had proceeded 20 yards it was difficult for the different individuals of the party to distinguish each other in the vapor. They had made their little circuit to the left, and were already inclining again towards the right, having, as Hayward thought, got over nearly half the distance to the friendly works, when his ears were saluted with the fierce summons, apparently within 20 feet of them, of "Qui va là?"
"Push on," whispered the scout, once more bending to the left. "Push on," repeated Hayward,
when the summons was renewed by a dozen voices, each of which seemed charged with menace.
"C'est moi!"
cried Duncan, dragging rather than leading those he supported swiftly onward.
"Bête! Qui, moi? Ami de la France! Tu m'as plus l'air d'un ennemi de la France. Arrête, ou par Dieu, je te ferai ami du diable. Non. Feu, camarade, feu!"
The order was instantly obeyed, and the fog was stirred by the explosion of 50 muskets. Happily, the aim was bad, and the bullets cut the air in a direction a little different from that taken by the fugitives. Though still so nigh them that to the unpracticed ears of David and the two females it appeared as if they whistled within a few inches of the organs. The outcry was renewed, and the order not only to fire again but to pursue was too plainly audible. When Hayward briefly explained the meaning of the words they heard, Hawkeye halted and spoke with quick decision and great firmness. "Let us deliver our fire," he said. "They will believe it a sortie, and give way, or they will wait for reinforcements." The scheme was well conceived, but failed in its effect. The instant the French heard the pieces, it seemed as if the plain was alive with men, muskets rattling along its whole extent, from the shores of the lake to the farthest boundary of the woods.
"We shall draw their entire army upon us, and bring on a general assault," said Duncan. "Lead on, my friend, for your own life and ours."
The scout seemed willing to comply, but in the hurry of the moment and in the change of position he had lost the direction. In vain he turned either cheek towards the light air. They felt equally cool. In this dilemma, Uncas lighted on the furrow of the cannonball where it had cut the ground in 3 adjacent anthills.
"Give me the range," said Hawkeye, bending to catch a glimpse of the direction, and then instantly moving onward.
Cries, oaths, voices calling to each other, and the reports of muskets were now quick and incessant, and apparently on every side of them. Suddenly a strong glare of light flashed across the scene, the fog rolled upwards in thick wreaths, and several cannon belched across the plain, and the roar was thrown heavily back from the bellowing echoes of the mountain.
"'Tis from the fort!" exclaimed Hawkeye, turning short on his tracks. "And we, like stricken fools, were rushing to the woods under the very knives of the Maquas."
The instant their mistake was rectified, the whole party retraced the error with the utmost diligence. Duncan willingly relinquished the support of Cora to the arm of Uncas, and Cora as readily accepted the welcome assistance. Men, hot and angry in pursuit, were evidently on their footsteps, and each instant threatened their capture, if not their destruction.
"Point de quartier au coquin!" cried an eager pursuer
who seemed to direct the operations of the enemy.
"Stand firm and be ready, my gallant 60ths!"
suddenly exclaimed a voice above them.
"Wait to see the enemy! Fire low and sweep the glassy!"
"Father! Father!" exclaimed a piercing cry from out the mist. "It is I, Alice, thy own Elsie! Spare, oh, save your daughters!"
"Hold!"
shouted the former speaker in the awful tones of parental agony, the sound reaching even to the woods and rolling back in solemn echo.
"'Tis she! God has restored me, my children! Throw open the sally port! To the field, 60ths, to the field! Pull not a trigger, lest ye kill my lambs! Drive off these dogs of France with your steel!"
Duncan heard the grating of the rusty hinges, and darting to the spot, directed by the sound, he met a long line of dark red warriors, passing swiftly toward the glacis. He knew them for his own battalion of the Royal Americans, and flying to their head, soon swept every trace of his pursuers from before the works. For an instant, Cora and Alice had stood trembling and bewildered by this unexpected desertion. But before either had leisure for speech or even thought, an officer of gigantic frame, whose locks were bleached with years in service, but whose air of military grandeur had been rather softened than destroyed by time, rushed out of the body of the mist and folded them to his bosom, while large, scalding tears rolled down his pale and wrinkled cheeks, and he exclaimed in the peculiar accent of Scotland,
"For this I thank thee, Lord. Let danger come as it will. Thy servant is now prepared."
Chapter 15. Then go we in to know his embassy, which I could with ready guess declare before the Frenchmen speak a word of it. King Henry V. A few succeeding days were passed amid the privations, the uproar, and the dangers of the siege, which was vigorously pressed by a power against whose approaches Monroe possessed no competent means of resistance. It appeared as if Webb, with his army which lay slumbering on the banks of the Hudson, had utterly forgotten the strait to which his countrymen were reduced. Montcalm had filled the woods of the portage with his savages, every yell and whoop from whom rang through the British encampment, chilling the hearts of men who were already but too much disposed to magnify the danger. Not so, however, with the besieged. Animated by the words and stimulated by the examples of their leaders, they had found their courage and maintained their ancient reputation with zeal that did justice to the stern character of their commander. As if satisfied with the toil of marching through the wilderness to encounter his enemy, the French general, though of approved skill, had neglected to seize the adjacent mountains, whence the besieged might have been exterminated with impunity, and which, in the more modern warfare of the country, would not have been neglected for a single hour. This sort of contempt for eminences, or rather dread of the labor of ascending them, might have been termed the besetting weakness of the warfare of the period. It originated in the simplicity of the Indian contests, in which, from the nature of the combats and the density of the forests, fortresses were rare and artillery next to useless. The carelessness engendered by these usages descended even to the War of the Revolution and lost the states the important fortress of Ticonderoga, opening a way for the army of Burgoyne into what was then the bosom of the country. We look back at this ignorance, or infatuation, whichever it may be called, with wonder, knowing that the neglect of an eminence, whose difficulties, like those of Mount Defiance, have been so greatly exaggerated, would at the present time prove fatal to the reputation of the engineer who had planned the works at their base, or to that of the general whose lot it was to defend them. The tourist, the valetudinarian, or the amateur of the beauties of nature, who, in the train of his foreign hand, now rolls through the scenes we have attempted to describe in quest of information, health, or pleasure, or floats steadily towards his object on those artificial waters which have sprung up under the administration of a statesman who has dared to stake his political character on the hazardous issue, is not to suppose that his ancestors traversed those hills or struggled with the same currents with equal facility. The transportation of a single heavy gun was often considered equal to a victory gained. If, happily, the difficulties of the passage had not so far separated it from its necessary concomitant, the ammunition, as to render it no more than an useless tube of unwieldy iron. The evils of this state of things pressed heavily on the fortunes of the resolute Scotsman who now defended William Henry. Though his adversary neglected the hills, he had planted his batteries with judgment on the plain, and caused them to be served with vigor and skill. Against this assault, the besieged could only oppose the imperfect and hasty preparations of a fortress in the wilderness. It was in the afternoon of the fifth day of the siege, and the fourth of his own service in it, that Major Hayward profited by a parley that had just been beaten, by repairing to the ramparts of one of the water bastions, to breathe the cool air from the lake, and to take a survey of the progress of the siege. He was alone, if the solitary sentinel who paced the mound be accepted, for the artillerists had hastened also to profit by the temporary suspension of their arduous duties. The evening was delightfully calm, and the light air from the limpid water fresh and soothing. It seemed as if, with the termination to the roar of artillery and the plunging of shot,
Nature had also seized the moment to assume her mildest and most captivating form. The sun poured down his parting glory on the scene, without the oppression of those fierce rays that belong to the climate and the season. The mountains looked green and fresh and lovely, tempered with a milder light or softened in shadow, as thin vapors floated between them and the sun. The numerous islands rested on the bosom of the hurricane, some low and sunken as if embedded in the waters, and others appearing to hover above the element in little hillocks of green velvet, among which the fishermen of the beleaguering army peacefully rowed their skiffs or floated at rest on the glassy mirror in quiet pursuit of their employment. The scene was at once animated and still. All that pertained to nature was sweet or simply grand, while those parts which depended on the temper and movements of man were lively and playful. Two little spotless flags were abroad, the one on a salient angle of the fort, and the other on the advanced battery of the besiegers, emblems of the truce which existed not only to the acts, but it would seem also to the enmity of the combatants. Between these again swung, heavily opening and closing in silken folds, the rival standards of England and France. 100 gay and thoughtless young Frenchmen were drawing a net to the pebbly beach, within dangerous proximity to the sullen but silent cannon of the fort, while the eastern mountain was sending back the loud shouts and gay merriment that attended their sport. Some were rushing eagerly to enjoy the aquatic games of the lake, and others were already toiling their way up the neighboring hills with the restless curiosity of their nation. To all these sports and pursuits, those of the enemy who watched the besieged, and the besieged themselves, were, however, merely the idle, though sympathizing, spectators. Here and there a picket had indeed raised a song or mingled in a dance which had drawn the dusky savages around them from their lairs in the forest. In short, everything wore rather the appearance of a day of pleasure than of an hour stolen from the dangers and toil of a bloody and vindictive warfare. Duncan had stood in a musing attitude, contemplating this scene a few minutes, when his eyes were directed to the glassy in front of the sallyport already mentioned by the sounds of approaching footsteps. He walked to an angle of the bastion and beheld the scout advancing, under the custody of a French officer, to the body of the fort. The countenance of Hawkeye was haggard and careworn, and his air dejected, as though he felt the deepest degradation at having fallen into the power of his enemies. He was without his favorite weapon, and his arms were even bound behind him with thongs made of the skin of a deer. The arrival of flags, to cover the messengers of summons, had occurred so often of late that when Hayward first threw his careless glance on this group, he expected to see another of the officers of the enemy charged with a similar office. But the instant he recognized the tall person and still sturdy, though downcast, features of his friend the woodsman, he started with surprise, and turned to descend from the bastion into the bosom of the work. The sounds of other voices, however, caught his attention, and for a moment caused him to forget his purpose. At the inner angle of the mound he met the sisters, walking along the parapet in search, like himself, of air and relief from confinement. They had not met from that painful moment when he deserted them on the plain only to assure their safety. He had parted from them worn with care and jaded with fatigue. He now saw them refreshed and blooming, though timid and anxious. Under such an inducement, it will cause no surprise that the young man lost sight for a time of other objects in order to address them. He was, however, anticipated by the voice of the ingenuous and youthful Alice.
"Ah, thou truant, thou recreant knight, he who abandons his damsels in the very lists," she cried. "Here have we been days, nay, ages, expecting you at our feet, imploring mercy and forgetfulness of your craven backsliding, or I should rather say back-running, for verily you fled in a manner that no stricken deer, as our worthy friend the scout would say, could equal."
"You know that Alice means our thanks and our blessings," added the graver and more thoughtful Cora. "In truth, we have a little wondered why you should so rigidly absent yourself from a place where the gratitude of the daughters might receive the support of a parent's thanks. Your father himself could tell you that though absent from your presence, I have not been altogether forgetful of your safety," returned the young man. "The mastery of yonder village of huts," pointing to the neighboring entrenched camp, "has been keenly disputed, and he who holds it is sure to be possessed of this fort,
and that which it contains. My days and my nights have all been passed there since we separated, because I thought that duty called me thither. But, he added with an air of chagrin which he endeavored, though unsuccessfully, to conceal, had I been aware that what I then believed a soldier's conduct could be so construed, shame would have been added to the list of reasons.
"Hayward! Duncan!"
exclaimed Alice, bending forward to read his half-averted countenance, until a lock of her golden hair rested on her flushed cheek and nearly concealed the tear that had started to her eye.
"Did I think this idle tongue of mine had pained you? I would silence it forever. Cora can say, if Cora would, how justly we have prized your services, and how deep—I had almost said how fervent is our gratitude."
"And will Cora attest the truth of this?" cried Duncan, suffering the cloud to be chased from his countenance by a smile of open pleasure. "What says our graver sister? Will she find an excuse for the neglect of the knight in the duty of a soldier?" Cora made no immediate answer, but turned her face towards the water as if looking on the sheet of the hurricane. When she did bend her dark eyes on the young man, they were filled with an expression of anguish that at once drove every thought but that of kind solicitude from his mind.
"You are not well, dearest Miss Monroe," he exclaimed. "We have trifled while you are in suffering."
"'Tis nothing," she answered, refusing his offered support with feminine reserve. "That I cannot see the sunny side of the picture of life, like this artless but ardent enthusiast," she added, laying her hand lightly but affectionately on the arm of her sister, "is the penalty of experience, and perhaps the misfortune of my nature. See," she continued, as if determined to shake off infirmity and a sense of duty, "look around you, Major Hayward, and tell me what a prospect is this for the daughter of a soldier whose greatest happiness is his honor and his military renown.
Neither ought nor shall be tarnished by circumstances over which he has had no control," Duncan warmly replied. "But your words recall me to my own duty. I go now to your gallant father, to hear his determination in matters of the last moment to the defense. God bless you in every fortune, noble Cora, I may and must call you."
She frankly gave him her hand, though her lip quivered, and her cheeks gradually became of an ashy paleness.
"In every fortune, I know you will be an ornament and honor to your sex.
Alice, adieu."
His tone changed from admiration to tenderness.
"Adieu, Alice.
We shall soon meet again, as conquerors, I trust, and amid rejoicings."
Without waiting for an answer from either, the young man threw himself down the grassy steps of the bastion, and moving rapidly across the parade, he was quickly in the presence of their father. Monroe was pacing his narrow apartment with a disturbed air and gigantic strides as Duncan entered.
"You have anticipated my wishes, Major Hayward," he said. "I was about to request this favor."
"I am sorry to see, sir, that the messenger I so warmly recommended has returned in custody of the French. I hope there is no reason to distrust his fidelity."
"The fidelity of the Long Rifle is well known to me," returned Monroe, "and is above suspicion, though his usual good fortune seems at last to have failed. Montcalm has got him, and with the accursed politeness of his nation he has sent him in with a doleful tale of knowing how I valued the fellow he could not think of retaining him. A Jesuitical way that, Major Duncan Hayward, of telling a man of his misfortunes."
"But the general and his succor?"
"Did ye look to the south as ye entered, and could ye not see them?" said the old soldier, laughing bitterly. "Hoot, hoot! Ye're an impatient boy, sir, and cannot give the gentlemen leisure for their march."
"They are coming, then? The scout has said as much?"
"When, and by what path? For the dunce has omitted to tell me this. There is a letter, it would seem, too, and that is the only agreeable part of the matter. For the customary attentions of your Marquis of Montcalm, I warrant me, Duncan, that he of Lothian would buy a dozen such marquisates. But if the news of the letter were bad, the gentility of this French monsieur would certainly compel him to let us know it."
"He keeps the letter, then, while he releases the messenger?"
"Aye, that does he. And all for the sake of what you call your bonhomie. I would venture, if the truth was known, the fellow's grandfather taught the noble science of dancing.
But what says the scout? He has eyes and ears and a tongue. What verbal report does he make?
Oh, sir, he is not wanting in natural organs, and he is free to tell all that he has seen and heard. The whole amount is this. There is a fort of His Majesty's on the banks of the Hudson, called Edward in honor of His Gracious Highness of York, you'll know, and it is well filled with armed men, as such a work should be.
But there was no movement? No signs of any intention to advance to our relief?
There were the morning and evening parades, and when one of the provincial loons, you'll know, Duncan, you're half a Scotsman yourself, when one of them dropped his powder over his porridge, if it touched the coals, it just burnt.
Then suddenly changing his bitter ironical manner to one more grave and thoughtful, he continued,
"And yet there might and must be something in that letter which it would be well to know."
"Our decision should be speedy," said Duncan, gladly availing himself of this change of humor to press the more important objects of their interview. "I cannot conceal from you, sir, that the camp will not be much longer tenable, and I am sorry to add that things appear no better in the fort. More than half the guns are bursted."
"And how should it be otherwise? Some were fished from the bottom of the lake, some have been rusting in the woods since the discovery of the country, and some were never guns at all, mere privateersmen's playthings. Do you think, sir, you can have Woolwich Warren in the midst of a wilderness 3,000 miles from Great Britain?"
"The walls are crumbling about our ears, and provisions begin to fail us," continued Hayward, without regarding this new burst of indignation. "Even the men show signs of discontent and alarm."
"Major Hayward," said Munro, turning to his youthful associate with the dignity of his years and superior rank, "I should have served His Majesty for half a century, and earned these gray hairs in vain, were I ignorant of all you say, and of the pressing nature of our circumstances. Still, there is everything due to the honor of the king's arms, and something to ourselves. While there is hope of succor, this fortress will I defend, though it be to be done with pebbles gathered on the lake shore. It is a sight of the letter, therefore, that we want, that we may know the intentions of the man the Earl of Loudoun has left among us as his substitute."
"And can I be of service in the matter?"
"Sir, you can. The Marquis of Montcalm has, in addition to his other civilities, invited me to a personal interview between the works and his own camp, in order, he says, to impart some additional information. No, I think it would not be wise to show any undue solicitude to meet him, and I would employ you, an officer of rank, as my substitute, for it would but ill comport with the honor of Scotland to let it be said one of her gentlemen was outdone in civility by a native of any other country on earth."
Without assuming the supererogatory task of entering into a discussion of the comparative merits of national courtesy, Duncan cheerfully assented to supply the place of the veteran in the approaching interview. A long and confidential communication now succeeded, during which the young man received some additional insight into his duty from the experience and native acuteness of his commander, and then the former took his leave. As Duncan could only act as the representative of the commandant of the fort, the ceremonies which should have accompanied a meeting between the heads of the adverse forces were, of course, dispensed with. The truce still existed, and with a roll and beat of the drum, and covered by a little white flag, Duncan left the sallyport within 10 minutes after his instructions were ended. He was received by the French officer in advance with the usual formalities, and immediately accompanied to a distant marquee of the renowned soldier who led the forces of France. The general of the enemy received the youthful messenger, surrounded by his principal officers and by a swarthy band of the native chiefs who had followed him to the field, with the warriors of their several tribes. Hayward paused short, when, in glancing his eyes rapidly over the dark group of the latter, he beheld the malignant countenance of Magua, regarding him with the calm but sullen attention which marked the expression of that subtle savage. A slight exclamation of surprise even burst from the lips of the young man, but instantly recollecting his errand, and the presence in which he stood, he suppressed every appearance of emotion,
and turned to the hostile leader, who had already advanced a step to receive him. The Marquis of Montcalm was, at the period of which we write, in the flower of his age, and, it may be added, in the zenith of his fortunes. But even in that enviable situation he was affable, and distinguished as much for his attention to the forms of courtesy as for that chivalrous courage which only 2 short years afterwards induced him to throw away his life on the plains of Abraham. Duncan, in turning his eyes from the malign expression of Magua, suffered them to rest with pleasure on the smiling and polished features and the noble military air of the French general.
"Monsieur," said the latter, "j'ai beaucoup de plaisir à... Bah! Où est cet interprète?"
"Je crois, monsieur, qu'il ne sera pas nécessaire," Hayward modestly replied. "Je parle un peu français."
"Ah, j'en suis bien aise," said Montcalm, taking Duncan familiarly by the arm, and leading him deep into the marquee, a little out of earshot. "Je déteste ces fripons-là. On ne sait jamais sur quel pied on est avec eux. Eh bien, monsieur," he continued, still speaking in French, "though I should have been proud of receiving your commandant, I am very happy that he has seen proper to employ an officer so distinguished, and who, I am sure, is so amiable as yourself."
Duncan bowed low, pleased with the compliment, in spite of a most heroic determination to suffer no artifice to allure him into forgetfulness of the interest of his prince. And Montcalm, after a pause of a moment as if to recollect his thoughts, proceeded.
"Your commandant is a brave man, and well qualified to repel my assault. And, mais, monsieur, is it not time to begin to take more counsel of humanity, and less of your courage? The one as strongly characterizes the hero as the other?"
"We consider the qualities as inseparable," returned Duncan, smiling. "But while we find in the vigor of your excellency every motive to stimulate the one, we can as yet see no particular call for the exercise of the other." Montcalm, in his turn, slightly bowed, but it was with the air of a man too practiced to remember the language of flattery. After musing a moment, he added,
"It is possible my glasses have deceived me, and that your works resist our cannon better than I had supposed. You know our force?"
"Our accounts vary," said Duncan carelessly. "The highest, however, has not exceeded 20,000 men." The Frenchman bit his lip and fastened his eyes keenly on the other as if to read his thoughts. Then, with a readiness peculiar to himself, he continued, as if assenting to the truth of an enumeration which quite doubled his army.
"It is a poor compliment to the vigilance of us soldiers, monsieur, that do what we will, we can never conceal our numbers. If it were to be done at all, one would believe it might succeed in these woods, though you think it too soon to listen to the calls of humanity," he added, smiling archly. "I may be permitted to believe that gallantry is not forgotten by one so young as yourself. The daughters of the commandant, I learn, have passed into the fort since it was invested."
"It is true, monsieur. But so far from weakening our efforts, they set us an example of courage in their own fortitude. Were nothing but resolution necessary to repel so accomplished a soldier as Monsieur de Montcalm, I would gladly trust the defense of William Henry to the elder of those ladies."
"We have a wise ordinance in our Salique laws, which says, 'The crown of France shall never degrade the lance to the distaff,'" said Montcalm dryly and with a little hauteur, but instantly adding, with his former frank and easy air, "As all the nobler qualities are hereditary, I can easily credit you. Though, as I said before, courage has its limits, and humanity must not be forgotten. I trust, monsieur, you come authorized to treat for the surrender of the place?"
"Has your excellency found our defense so feeble as to believe the measure necessary?"
"I should be sorry to have the defense protracted in such a manner as to irritate my red friends there," continued Montcalm, glancing his eyes at the group of grave and attentive Indians, without attending to the other's question. "I find it difficult, even now, to limit them to the usages of war."
Hayward was silent, for a painful recollection of the dangers he had so recently escaped came over his mind, and recalled the images of those defenseless beings who had shared in all his sufferings.
Say, Monsieur là, said Montcalm, following up the advantage which he conceived he had gained. Are most formidable when baffled, and it is unnecessary to tell you with what difficulty they are restrained in their anger. Eh bien, monsieur, shall we speak of the terms?
I fear your excellency has been deceived as to the strength of William Henry and the resources of its garrison.
I have not sat down before Quebec, but an earthenwork that is defended by 2,300 gallant men, was the laconic reply.
Our mounds are earthen, certainly, nor are they seated on the rocks of Cape Diamond, but they stand on that shore which proved so destructive to Dieskau and his army. There is also a powerful force within a few hours' march of us, which we account upon as part of our means.
Some 6,000 or 8,000 men, returned Montcalm, with much apparent indifference, whom their leader wisely judges to be safer in their works than in the field.
It was now Hayward's turn to bite his lip with vexation, as the other so coolly alluded to a force which the young man knew to be overrated. Both mused a little while in silence, when Montcalm renewed the conversation in a way that showed he believed the visit of his guest was solely to propose terms of capitulation.
On the other hand, Hayward began to throw sundry inducements in the way of the French general to betray the discoveries he had made through the intercepted letter. The artifice of neither, however, succeeded, and after a protracted and fruitless interview, Duncan took his leave, favorably impressed with an opinion of the courtesy and talents of the enemy's captain, but as ignorant of what he came to learn as when he arrived. Montcalm followed him as far as the entrance of the Marquis, renewing his invitations to the commandant of the fort to give him an immediate meeting in the open ground between the two armies. There they separated, and Duncan returned to the advanced post of the French, accompanied as before, whence he instantly proceeded to the fort and to the quarters of his own commander.